You are listening to the Tricorder Transmissions Special. Episode 1. And
now,
here are
Craig
and
Jeff.
You're invited to engage your senses, transport your spirit, and boldly go where no one has gone before. The 24th century is coming to the Las Vegas Hilton. Star Trek, the experience. Feel the excitement as you beam up to the bridge of the Enterprise. Travel through space and time aboard a Starfleet shuttlecraft. And dock at the alien outpost Deep Space Nine for the finest in dining and shopping. Make your plans to be among the first in the galaxy to beam up to 24th century adventure. Star Trek, the experience. Coming soon to the Las Vegas Hilton.
Hello and welcome to this supplemental edition of the Tricorder Transmissions. I'm Craig Cohen.
And I'm Jeff Hewlett. Today we are very happy to have with us two extremely special guests, April Hebert and Vernon Wilmer, both former actors from the Star Trek Experience in Las Vegas.
And in addition to being an actor at the Experience, Vernon has made an excellent series of documentaries chronicling the entire history of that attraction.
So April and Vernon, welcome to the show.
Hi.
So one of the things that's pointed out in the documentary, which is excellent, by the way, which I can't stress enough.
It is awesome.
Is that you guys both had a love of Star Trek prior to your time there. Do you mind getting a little bit more into your Star Trek history, you know, prior to working at the Experience?
Sure. Well, I've been a longtime Star Trek fan. I used to tell people on the backstage tour that I did that Captain Kirk was my first crush. And long history with Trek, although I really never called myself a Trekkie. Mm. And I never went to a convention until I actually got paid to go as a character. But I've always loved, well, I like any kind of sci-fi at all, but I just always loved Star Trek. When the movies started coming out, I started watching them, and, you know, I cried when Spock died. I got really mad when they blew up my ship in Search for Spock. I have a history with it.
All right. I've always been a Trekkie. I was, standard nerd boy that grew up in the 70s watching it in syndication. And loved the movies. I have equal love of Star Wars and Star Trek. There's room for both in my heart.
We agree.
Yeah, it sounds like Vernon and I are very similar in that respect.
Excellent. And it was just a fluke that I ended up auditioning and getting cast at the Experience when I came here to Nevada. Right. It was just unexpected circumstance.
Mm-hmm. Now
serendipitous.
Exactly. Now it's briefly covered in the documentary, but so your basically door into the Experience was more of an audition process as opposed to an interview experience, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, the original interview process, there were about 5,000 of us to audition for 120 positions back in 97. So, yeah, that was crazy. It took a couple of days to get through all those people.
And when I came in, that was halfway through Star Trek's run when they added Borg Invasion. So that was a much smaller audition. They did it in small groups in-house over the course of about a month.
Now, April, how many different characters did you play in your time at the Experience? Me and Jeff were trying to figure it out.
Yeah, through the docs, we saw quite a few.
Well, actually, I pretty much did everything in the entire operations department over the course of the 11 years. But I started out as a Starfleet officer up in the Klingon Experience, which was the first ride there. I also served as a trainer. I kind of wrote the training manual so I would train the new people as they came in. At one point, I was a lead, so I was kind of like a supervisor, but I really would rather be acting, you know? So at some point, I went back up into the ride, and at that point, they gave me a Vulcan character to play. So I was in the ride as a Vulcan character for a year or two. And then they actually decided that I should go out onto the floor with the, you know, with the other characters. At the time, when we first opened, there were Klingons and Ferengi. But as time passed, then they added a Borg character. And then when I went onto the floor, we had a Vulcan character. So I played a Vulcan character and an Andorian character. Out on the floor. So I got to play like two incredibly opposite characters, which was actually kind of good. Very, very therapeutic.
So Vernon, I saw in the documentary that you spent a lot of time playing a Borg inside the Borg 4D experience, assimilating a crewman.
Yeah, that was my, there were 14 or 16 Borg hired initially for Borg Invasion. We would rotate through both the attraction and walk-around characters on, you know, the promenade. That ended pretty quickly that first year. We were just relegated to the attraction after that because we had a standout floorboard character. It was Michael Hartnett as 3 of 6. And it was thought that he should stand alone on the promenade. So we were just kept in Borg Invasion. And I was actually the first Borg. I was one of the Borg that was initially hired. I was the first Borg to do the opening of Borg Invasion. And all the other Borg fell away over the years. And I was the last Borg standing from Borg Invasion at the end.
Oh, wow. Towards the end of the run of the experience, you were not out on the floor. It was just 3 of 6 who was out there?
Yeah, 3 of 6 was... from 2002 all the way up till 2008, he was always on the floor. The Borg Invasion Borg were only used as like kind of props instead of characters, and were very rarely used on the floor or in weddings.
So I have a picture of myself, and Craig has one too, from right before the closing with the Borg on the floor. I was wondering if that was you or not, but I guess it wasn't.
Well, if you send me the picture, I can identify them for you. I know all the Borg by sight.
Absolutely. We'll send it to you after the show. So, Craig, you had something you were going to say?
Yeah, no. Since we're talking about the Borg invasion, maybe you guys could give a little bit of insight into a question I had regarding what was it like for them doing construction on that attraction or that added part of the experience while the experience was up and running.
Well, I can actually speak to that because when we opened in 98, we actually had two Klingon encounter rides. We had two bridges, two turbolifts, two theaters. Each theater had two shuttles. And they did that initially because we knew that there were going to be thousands and thousands of people who wanted to come. And, you know, we didn't want them to have to stand in line all day to do a 20-minute ride. So, We had people coming through constantly. We had a new group coming through like every 2.5 minutes on either side. And we just ran, we could run up to 600 people through an hour. Wow. So at some point, actually the ridership went down. That just happens naturally in any theme park ride. But at that point, that's when they decided to close down one side and put the Borg invasion in there. So it really only took 18 months from the time they decided to do it until they actually opened the new ride. And they just closed one side off and gutted it, basically, and we weren't allowed to go anywhere near that when there was construction going on. So we just kind of had one side going, and so it was, and you know, it really didn't impact us too much.
Mm-hmm. And they did save the bridge from that side. It was the only part that was left untouched by Borg Invasion. They figured they needed an extra bridge to hold weddings on and special events. That came in handy.
All right. And Vernon, I think on the documentary you explained that the Borg Invasion was sort of an offshoot from what they were doing over in Germany?
Yeah, Borg Invasion was not built for us specifically. It was meant to be part of Star Trek The Tour in Europe. And when the tour didn't go so well, they just modified Borg Invasion and basically, you know, threw it over to us.
And when did Borg Invasion actually open?
That would have been St. Patrick's Day of 2004.
All right, Jeff. So Jeff, you actually, your first time at the experience was when it was a single ride, huh?
Yeah, my first visit to the experience was in 2003. I think kind of fall of 2003. I was in Vegas.
Yeah, we were probably under construction for the Borg Invasion then. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember I was flying solo. I was there for a convention that was going on in the Hilton, and I went to the experience, and I remember waiting in line. I don't remember there being two separate lines at the time. I remember being in one line along the left side of a hallway,
right,
waiting to get on the Klingon line. So I may very well have seen you there.
No doubt you did. I was there all the time. I lived there for 11 years, practically.
2003, you might have seen me there too, but as a tourist, not an employee.
Oh, wow. Craig, you had something you wanted to say there?
Yeah, actually, I was curious to ask you guys what the makeup and costuming experience was like in terms of how much time did it consume, and April, for you, which costume was or makeup was harder to get into?
Well, in terms of time, I actually got the Vulcan makeup down to about an hour, you know, all told. The Andorian, because I had to paint myself blue, or at least the parts of me that were, you know, not covered by a costume. So that was a little bit more high maintenance. it took about the whole hour and a half. We were given an hour and a half of makeup time, all the characters were. So I had my Vulcan ears were made for me by one of the actors that worked at the experience, George Reith. He passed away about a year and a half ago, but he was really, really good at it. You know, he'd studied with, he went down and went to Michael Westmore's studio and talked to him about how to do the ears. And so he kept me in ears for the entire time that I was a Vulcan. So I always had, you know, some nice ears and a wig and learned all the tricks of the trade. And Michael Westmore actually came a couple of times to instruct us and to see what we were doing. And he was very pleased with what we were doing. But so, yeah, the Vulcan wasn't too intense, but putting on all that blue makeup and all the shading and stuff, that took quite a while. Mm-hmm.
Before we get to Vernon, did you ever find yourself doing the wrong character in the wrong makeup?
No, you know, I have to tell you that the kind of actor I am, so much of what I do has to do with how I look. And that's kind of like once I put on that character, that makeup, then I completely become that character. And I never got the two of them confused.
Now, Vernon, you were a Borg, so I'd imagine that the Borg costuming and makeup was a little bit more challenging than some of the other makeup.
You know, there's a lot of things I miss about the experience, but I do not miss wearing that outfit. We had very little makeup to do because only our hands and small portions of our face were exposed. Everything else was covered. We were covered from head to toe in very thick foam latex. And it was very hot and very uncomfortable.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that because when when Craig and I were there in 2008, just before the closing, and we met up with the floorborg, as it was, the costume that he had on looked very heavy, and it looked almost like he was having a little bit of a tougher time, you know, moving around in it. So when you were wearing those, you had to wear those for a long shift. How long were the normal shifts?
The floorborg was different from the attraction Borg. Michael would have to be on the floor for approximately 30 minutes entertaining mm-hmm. guests, and then he would have 30 minutes off and get out of the costume and relax. That went on for, I believe, depending on what our schedule was like, anywhere from a 6 to an 8 hour shift. the attraction board were basically an hour on and an hour off. And you always loved going on break because you got out of the, you'd have to go to wardrobe. They would have to get you out of the costume. It's almost impossible to do by yourself. Taking out the undressing and dressing time, you had about 30 minutes to relax.
Wow. So was it commonplace for people to, did you change characters during the same day, or was it a different week by week thing? Or,
well, now if you were up in the ride, for those who were up in the ride, except the Borg, they were always the Borg. Mm-hmm. But in the ride, because it was scripted, what we would do would be to rotate through the different characters. So over the course of a day, you could pretty much play every single character on both sides, on both of the different rides. But out on the floor, because of the makeup time, I was whoever I was that for the entire day. So I think on... Because I worked four 10-hour shifts, and on Friday and Saturday, I was Commander Tarin of the Andorian Imperial Guard, and Sunday and Monday, I was Professor T'Pril. So, that was my week, basically.
There were days where I played a Starfleet officer on the Borg invasion side, but I never did both roles in the same day.
Now, one thing that I really loved about the experience was it really felt like you were in the 24th century. I was able to go there and really lose myself and escape reality for however long I was there. As performers, you know, what was the experience like in terms of, your character history and establishing that? And did you work from pre-existing stories, or was it just something you were able to create?
From the very beginning, we were very, very careful to try and make our characters, in keeping with the Star Trek universe, everything that had gone before us. So a lot of our time was spent in looking at old Star Trek episodes. We did a lot of character building and character development. And before we could go out onto the floor as an alien character, we really had to kind of pass the test of all the other characters that were out there. And we worked with each other to make sure that our backstories were consistent. And, but once we got out onto the floor, because we were all improv actors, once we had that set, we were working within the parameters of the Star Trek universe. But, after that, anything goes. And so we would be out there interacting with the humans on the station and the guests that came onto the station and each other. So we actually concocted some pretty complicated stories.
And
it was very, very fun. And our regular customers, part of the draw for them was to come and interact with us, in the creation of these stories. And we would pull these people in and make them a part of it, which was, for them, it must have been so awesome. It was great for us because we had foils to work on, and it really made us, it made us a family, and I mean, the characters were a family, our characters cared about the other characters, and or maybe not. One of my characters, my Andorian character, was pretty cranky, and she only got along with certain people. The qualities that each character had made it really interesting to interact not only with each other as characters, but with the people that would come onto the station and interact with us.
I don't know if this ever came out on the floor in a performance, but the Klingons, at least backstage, had this, they made up a Klingon venereal disease that they were all afraid to pass around to each other called the spikes. Cracked me up.
So you mentioned that you had drawn some of the repeat customers and fans into some of the backstories. Do you have any particular memories of any interactions you had with fans or repeat customers that really are special to you?
Oh, okay. This One time, Professor T'Pril, my Vulcan character, was out on the floor. When I say out on the floor, I mean in Quarks and the promenade area, you know, interacting with guests. And this woman came up to me and she said, "Oh, so you can do the, you know, the Vulcan neck pinch or something of that." And she wanted to see me do the Vulcan neck pinch. She wanted to see me do it on somebody. And so I looked, you know, a couple of feet away from me, and there was Quan, one of our Ferengi. And he wasn't even paying attention to the interaction that I was having with this woman. But I said, perfectly in character, I said, "Ah, yes. Well, it goes a little something like this." And I reached over and I grabbed Quan's neck, and he immediately stiffened up and bam, face first right onto the bar.
Ooh.
And it did not even skip a beat. The lady was beside herself. Everybody else in the bar was cracking up, and he played it. You know, he didn't even know what was happening. All he did was feel the pinch on his neck and he was gone, because he knew I was somewhere in the vicinity. But that's how close we were. That's how much we knew each other. And it got a big laugh. She was very happy.
That was the best thing about you character actors. You were always ready to play and knew every detail of what was going on.
Yeah, so Vernon, let's talk a little bit about your documentary series, My Star Trek Experience. It's pretty amazing in the sense that you have 90 minute and 2 hour installments. How did you go about first of all coming up with the idea for it, and then compiling all of the footage and doing all of the research that you did?
Well, first I want to start off by saying that those three episodes that are currently online should be considered very rough cuts. I'm going back through and re-editing everything in high definition.
Oh, excellent.
I'll probably stop posting them online. I might make them only available as DVDs through the Facebook page
for
the documentary. But that's something probably towards the end of the year. But I started getting into it because I've always been a frustrated filmmaker ever since I was a kid. I dabbled in entertainment a little bit in L.A., but when I got this job at The Experience, it was such a magical thing. I thought I should document every second from, you know, the moment I was hired for as long as I was there, and then someday when it was gone, because all good things end, I would just make my opus about it. Here's this cool thing I got to do. But the project grew so large over the years, it went from being a small documentary to a documentary series of feature-length episodes, because the more that people found out what I was doing, the more they started volunteering material. And that still goes on to this day. Next week, I'm meeting with one of the early actresses there who has a ton of photos for me to scan into the archive from backstage.
Now, were you friendly or friends with April prior to or through working at The Experience? And you know, did you approach her about doing this documentary, or is it sort of a friendship that grew from doing the documentary?
I didn't know anybody there. I had just moved here from California and pretty much immediately got the job just a few months into living here. I was still getting set up. And I didn't know these people would all become my family. They're my family now. The funny thing about April, she didn't even know who the hell I was for the first number of months I worked there. The Borg Invasion cast was very separated from the Klingon Encounter cast. They kind of viewed us as these new kids coming in, taking over their, you know, their hours and their building. But I'd like to think I'm one of the people who started bridging the gap and being social with everybody. Eventually, the two crews integrated. But no, as far as the documentary goes, I never really talked to any of my friends at work about it. I didn't even started until after The Experience closed. I was just collecting material for it while I was working there.
So, Vernon, we both, Craig and I both watched all three parts of the documentary. And something that I had wondered about was, did you have to get any special permission
I never get permission to do anything ever. It's more of a forgiveness versus permission sort
Understood.
Of thing. In fact, first few weeks I worked there, they stressed the no cameras policy. You know, you can't take pictures in here. But then when we were being fitted for masks and costumes, they were taking a bunch of pictures because out of necessity. Those pictures started getting shared, and eventually people just started sneaking cameras in and taking photos, and I just ran with it. I did get myself in trouble a couple of times, not the least of which was making a little kind of a home Star Trek movie backstage between shows, and then YouTube had just become popular in like 2006. I decided to go ahead and post it. Paramount saw it, and they contacted our management, and they went nuts. I was almost fired immediately.
Wow. So in terms of doing the research, one of the things I really loved about the early episode was I didn't know any of the particulars that led to the experience being there. For me, it was sort of just like, okay, one day the experience opened up in Las Vegas. How did
it just magically appeared?
How did you dig through that history, or did you rely on people like April and other local Las Vegas, you know, citizens to sort of piece that together? Did you go to the library? Did you use Google? Like, how did you really construct that or put that puzzle together?
Well, it comes from caring and being a documentarian, like I am, an amateur documentarian. But any piece of information I was missing, I would go to a number of sources, the people who had been at the experience since day one. Sometimes management would commission me to do in-house videos, and I would get access to a lot of archived stuff. There was a lot of Googling after the experience closed. There's no shortage of articles on how the experience got started. There's even been articles in books that I've had on my shelf for ages and never knew the story was in there. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I there's still a ton of stuff I don't know. But I think I've got the biggest collection of material on the experience that anybody, you know, bothered to ever put together.
Well, no, it's
probably Paramount Parks.
No, it's great that you're doing it, and it's excellent work. And I know Jeff were really excited to discover it as fans of the experience.
Yeah,
and
we were.
One interesting story that that you told April on the in one of the installments involved Hollywood military advisor Dale Dye. What was it like working with him?
You know, I have to tell you that he showed up when I was still, because I had been the first person, well, Kirsten and I had been hired to come in early and test the equipment. So we were testing shuttles one day, and here comes our show director with this guy with eyes that could just look right through you. I'd never seen anybody like this, just really lean, tight guy with, you know, muscles on his muscles, but small, you know, wiry, and white hair. And he came in and they introduced him as Dale Dye. I didn't know who the heck that was. And he took my hand and he held my hand and he shook my hand and he looked into my eyes, and I thought I was being scanned. You know, I never had anybody look at me like that before. And afterwards I said, who was that guy? And he said, well, the show director was like, well, he's gonna be working with you guys. And so I thought he was some kind of director or something. I had no idea. And then after, you know, after everybody came in and we started rehearsing and that kind of thing, then all of a sudden they said, and Dale Dye is going to come and work with us for a couple of days. And I have to tell you that I didn't know what that entailed, but it was boot camp. So we worked outside all day, you know, and from 9 to 5 for 2 solid days with Captain Dye. And, you know, we had to call him Captain. And if he said drop and give me 20, you did. And it wasn't the fake ones, you know. I mean, it was crazy. I ran 5 miles, you know, and I'd never done that before. And we played, we didn't play games, you know, I mean, but there were military games that we played. I had never experienced anything like that at all. But I'll tell you what, by the time it was over, we were a crew and we were Starfleet. He dismissed us. We went and we picked up our uniforms and we got dressed and we stood in the grand corridor, all 120 of us, and he went down the aisles and inspected every single one of us, and we had to stand at attention while that happened. So that took about an hour and a half, and we're standing at attention the whole time. But you know, then afterwards we all took a big group photo together, which is one of my favorite pictures. But yeah, that was something, and I think it really did bring us together, because before that we were just a bunch of actors, but after that we were a crew, and we were a Starfleet crew.
So, Vernon, since you came in a little bit later on in the experience, what was your training and preparation experience?
Well, for the Borg, it was a lot different from any other kind of training. We were taught in action and how not to speak and how not to emote. We were basically, we were movable props in Borg Invasion. We had no dialogue. We had to learn how to move correctly and react correctly. That's about it. It entailed a lot of watching Borg episodes, sitting backstage. And I remember our trainer, Paul Mattingly, who was another one of the character actors there, he had lined up a number of Borg episodes for us. And one was coming up that I hated. The one with Hugh, Third of Five. It's called iBorg.
Yeah, iBorg.
I just had to raise my hand and said, Paul, can we skip that one?
Yeah, not one of my favorite Borg episodes.
And he goes, okay, Vernon, you got it. We're going to skip that one. You know, they taught us how to do our makeup, and then finally the costumes came in, and the hardest part of that job was getting into those costumes. It took us a long time to learn how to do it.
I don't want to harp too much on the closure of the experience, but as we mentioned, me and Jeff were there in August, and it was pretty pretty touching to see that that wall of memories. What did that whole experience mean to you guys? And do you have any special memories from the last few months at the experience?
Well, as for me, you know, I have to tell you that I knew that it was finite, that there, from the very beginning, you know, it was such a thrill for me to be a part of it. You know, when it was under construction, I was there, you know, so I got to see it become what it was, and I got to see it change over the years. But there was a part of me that always knew that it wouldn't be there forever. So whenever I had the opportunity, I would just stop and look around and see where I was and just take it in and try to commit every single aspect of it to memory. And I think I did a pretty good job of that. You know, it lives inside me. I don't know how else to explain it. But, you know, it was sad when, you know, the day they called us all together and said that it was closing. But I had expected it, because I knew that someday it was going to close. And I knew that I was going to be there until that happened. And after that, you know, when people started coming in and put the wall of memories up there, people came back, you know, once they knew that it closed, there were people that made special trips just to see us one more time. And that really meant something to me to know that. And they would tell us that. And some friends of ours, Jerry and Francine, actually made a point to come to Quark's every night. I think, how long did they?
Over a month.
I think
like,
it was like
41 days.
I think it was more than that. I think it was like 55 days or whatever, because we had 2 months, you know, from the time they said it was going to close till it actually closed. And so once the word got out that it was closing, Jerry and Francine were there every single night in the bar.
I have to say about Jerry and Francine as quickly as I can. We have a lot of friends that were guests at the experience that just chose to befriend us. But those two, starting with they had a bridge wedding at Star Trek The Experience in 2005. I was the Borg in their wedding party. and Chirac. We had Chirac, the Klingon, Mark Weitz. Well, after my shift, I usually went to Quark's to hang out and drink as a civilian, and there they were in the bar. They recognized me. They bought me a drink. They showed me their photos, and we've been really close friends ever since then. And even after the experience closed, their home is open to us. They throw us parties all the time, the cast, the crew. They've even attempted to, well, successfully recreate, as best they could, Quark's bar in their living room.
I was going to ask about this.
That's excellent.
I was actually going to ask about this really quick, if you don't mind. I did stumble upon a YouTube video of this with April in it. I was going to bring this up later, kind of jokingly, but since you segued right into it, how did you get talked into that, April?
Oh, you know what? That was my idea.
How did I get talked into it?
It was really what I wanted to do. We did it for the convention. You know, there's a Star Trek convention creation puts one on every year in Las Vegas. And so I wanted to do one. And what I wanted to do was kind of like closure. Because, you know, when we ended, we ended. So there wasn't any end to the stories that we had created for these characters over the years. You know, it was just, well, the time station is going back through the wormhole, you know, where it came from. But there was no specific end to any of these character arcs. So I thought it would be a really good idea. And I got a hold of as many people as I could, you know, previous characters, and said, is it okay if I say this about your character? And they were pretty much for it, you know? And if I couldn't get a hold of them, then hopefully they liked what I did. But yeah, so then it just took us one night really to, well, it's pretty much a day.
And that was shot at Jerry and Francine's with what we call the Labrador Grotto.
Yeah. And Jerry and Francine were in it, you know, because they were such an important part of Quark's. So they definitely needed to be in it. But yeah, it gave closure, I think, to, you know, what are these characters doing now? Because people would say that to me, you know, I wonder what those the Klingon is doing now. You know, what's Major Kalen doing? You know, that kind of thing. So it actually was pretty funny, and it won. It won a prize at the convention, which was fun. And they actually showed it, and I wasn't there when they showed it to the crowd, but I guess the crowd just went nuts when they played it.
I caught the rear end of the viewing. It got a lot of audience reaction. People at the conventions are always hungry for anything experience, old news, new news, hanging out with us. We were asked for our autographs, for God's sakes, this year. And so, it's been 5 years since the place closed.
So would you guys mind if I added a link to that video in the show notes so that people listening to the show can see what the video we're talking about?
That'll be great. Just forgive my acting.
I thought it was great. I watched it a couple days ago.
The best part, my favorite part of that video is the cameo by Castran. It's hilarious. I love that.
Now, April, you were there from the beginning to the end. Was that pretty much the case with a lot of the performers there?
Well, Kirsten and I, Kirsten played Castran, the other Andorian. Kirsten and I started on August 4th of 1997, very, very few people who were there at the very, very beginning ended up there at the very, very end. I'm thinking just a handful, actually.
A dozen at the most.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but they didn't come on until November. So, you know, I kind of beat them by a couple of months.
Mm-hmm. Now, Vernon, I'm not sure if you can answer this or not, but I do know that after the experience closed, there was talk of it opening up back downtown. Ultimately, what happened to everything that was there? I know some of it was sold off, but where did a lot of the stuff from the History of the Future Museum end up? And where did the rides end up?
Okay, long story short, when it was accepted that the experience was going to be closed and deconstructed, there was the hope and the plan that it was going to reopen elsewhere in Vegas. No solid plans, but there was a hope. So most things, which were, you know, directly ride-related and theme-related, were put into a local storage warehouse. The History of the Future Museum items were to be shipped back to probably Penny Judae's warehouse. No, that had already been emptied. They just shipped back to CBS or Paramount. And a lot of stuff was simply junked and trashed. Now, it took over 2 months to deconstruct the experience, so there was a lot of looting by outside people, by inside people. Some of us, got our mementos on the way out the door on the last day. So the experience is really just scattered to the wind, and it took a long time to do. There's still stuff on eBay to this day. Alec Peters, who runs PropWorks, was entrusted to officially auction off the remaining assets that were in storage. There was also a local sale held at that warehouse for things that were too big to transport to auction.
I don't know if you've heard about the bridge restoration project that Houston Huddleston is doing, but he actually bought some of those pieces, and in conjunction with some other pieces that he found that had been made for the world tour or something like that. I can't remember. But there were other bridge, Enterprise D bridge pieces out there. So he actually kind of cobbled it together, and he's now in the process of reconstructing an actual Enterprise D bridge set in LA. And he's taken that around to some conventions, and he's a great guy. So anybody out there, shout out to support that, because, you know, there's a lot of stuff there that is near and dear to me.
Excellent.
Plans, just going back to this real quick, to revive the experience shortly after its closure, the reason everything was put into storage, that died very quickly, by the way.
Well, that's because it happened at the start of the recession.
Yep.
So the guy who had... He put a big sum of money down, you know, to buy the rights to it. But he ended up losing that because he could not get funding.
Couldn't get investors.
Yeah, it was very sad. But
that's when the decision was made to just take whatever was left and sell it off to the fans.
So I saw in the documentary early on there were some visits to the experience by some of the stars of some of the series, like Jonathan Frakes and Kate Mulgrew. Did you guys get to spend any time with them while they were there?
Too much time sometimes. I really upset Shatner once.
Oh.
He was there in 2006 for filming a promo for the 40th anniversary of Star Trek. Like I said, the Borg have to run the wardrobe, get undressed. If you've got to pee, it's a horrible experience. And Shatner had closed off the employee break room area so he could have it for himself. So this Borg goes running past his men and gets undressed in wardrobe and invades the bathroom. Oh, what's going on here? I thought I had this all to myself.
You never said that story.
That's a good one.
That's fabulous.
What about you, April? Anything?
I am not a big fan of the cult of personality. I think these people are actors just like me. They do their job. You know, they come and do their job. So some of them came through the experience, and what I wanted to do when they came through the ride was take them through the ride and be a character, you know? Mm-hmm. So I was... the Ensign Thomas character, which in the Klingon Encounter side is kind of the main character. Not really. They're, you know, it's a team effort, but this is the one who gets their name said more than anybody else. So I was Ensign Thomas for Jonathan Frakes at the very, very beginning. And at the end of the turbo lift, when the people are exiting to go onto the shuttle, as he walked by me, he leaned over and said, "Good job, Ensign Thomas." You know, so that's one of my claims to fame. And the other time was when Patrick Stewart came through. He only came through the ride one time. And when I heard that, I ran upstairs and into the ride, and I begged the person that was Ensign Thomas for that show. I said, "Please, please, please let me do it." And they did let me do it because they weren't a Trekkie and they didn't care, you know. So I got to do that.
We befriended a lot of the celebrities from Star Trek. They're just a part of our family now. And it's funny because as a kid, just watching Star Trek and being a fan and glorifying these celebrities on TV and in the movies, mm-hmm. now they're Star friends, and they were hanging out at the Experience. Chase Masterson was present for our final shows on the
Chase
final day.
Is a sweetheart.
She was very into the whole ceremony. And, you know, I had a moment there. At the end of the last Borg Invasion show, the audience collected themselves together and applauded us. And I realized I'm a Borg. I'm looking down at Chase Masterson, who's looking up at me and clapping. And not many years before that, I was a fan of Deep Space Nine going, wow, Chase Masterson, Lita, how cool. And it was a bizarre reversal.
Yeah, and Susie Plaxen, who was, you know, the master of ceremonies, basically, for our decommissioning ceremony, and, you know, ended up having tears in her eyes at the end, you know, which was pretty cool. And Garrick Wong, and I'm trying to think of who else, Manu, and who else, Scarlett. Lots of cool
hanging
people.
Out with Manu and Scarlett. That's these Voyager kids.
They're grown up
drinking
now.
Buddies. It's awesome.
So one more thing I wanted to ask April about specifically. I was during the part three of the documentary, I saw you did a little stand-up routine about blondes. And I got a kick out of that.
Oh, my God, is that in there? I don't even remember.
That's in there. So is stand-up something that you enjoy doing, or is that just a spur-of-the-moment kind of thing for you?
You know, I did it for a bit. Some of the actors at the Experience are wonderful comedians, and they kind of talked me into doing it. So I did it for a while. I'm so busy. I loved it. It was fun. And I actually got a good response, and I had people asking me when I was going to do it again. But I never did, which was sad because that was pretty fun. Sometimes I think about doing it again.
You seem to have a little bit of a talent for that, by the way.
Oh, why, thank you. Yeah, you know what? I teach, you know, full time. So I'm so busy that people ask me to do stuff, and it's so hard to fit it into my schedule, you know. But yeah, I'm always up for doing something fun. Just haven't had the opportunity.
And one more for Vernon real quick. I wanted to ask you, what was the inspiration behind your Duck Dodgers Star Trek III mashup video?
That's one of my earliest videos. I won a convention competition with that one way back in the mid-90s, I think. The inspiration for that, I think I remember exactly, it was 1987. It was the 10th anniversary Star Wars celebration in L.A., mm-hmm. and some college kids had done a Duck Dodgers video similar to that, but with Return of the Jedi footage. And it was the funniest thing I've ever seen. And being an amateur editor, I went home and thought, well, I want to do something like that, but not, you know, I got to make it different. And I was watching Star Trek III one day, and I thought, oh, well, there's footage there that'll fit perfectly into that, probably even better than the Star Wars one did. So I, you know, it was not my idea. I stole it from somebody else. I just put, you know, changed it up a bit. And they've been playing it at the con ever since I entered it. It's played every year.
Yeah, I remember seeing you were saying that in the documentary. I got a big charge out of that video. My uncle's a huge fan of the Duck Dodgers, and I remember seeing it when I was a kid. So I got a laugh out of that.
Excellent.
So we didn't really plug yet exactly where people can find the documentary. Vernon, what is the best way for people to connect with your documentary right now?
Currently, the three, what I call rough cuts of the first three episodes, are watchable on blip.tv. They're very low resolution uploads, and the edits are very rough, but it's pretty much all you can see of it right now. There'll be 9 more episodes in the future, and with the additional re-editing of those first three episodes, I'm going to introduce them all as DVDs through my Facebook page, which is called Star Trek My Experience. It's a page dedicated to the documentary and Star Trek the Experience in general.
All right, great. And we'll be sure to share all those links on the episode information for this page. And April, I you said that you're teaching now. You're also
yes.
on Twitter. Is that the best way for people to connect with you?
Yeah, you can connect with me on Twitter. You can also, by the way, connect with Commander Tarin on Twitter, because at the end of that little YouTube video, you find out that she is stuck back here in the 21st century and trying desperately to get the hell off this rock. So she doesn't tweet a lot, but yeah, you could follow her on Twitter as well. That's Commander Tarin, Tahryn, and or you can just find me as April Abert, which is APRILHEBERT. That's my Twitter handle, and I would love to talk to people, about their memories of the experience.
All right. Well, that's great. And one thing that we want to talk to you about related to the original series on the Tricorder Transmissions here, what we're doing is we're going through every episode and sort of doing a running commentary.
I know. It's cool. I've been listening to you.
All right. Thanks. So do you, April, have a favorite episode of the original series that you would like to join us for when we get to it?
Oh, my God. Oh, jeez. I love City on the Edge of Forever. I also like the Paradise Syndrome. It's like my guilty pleasure. I know.
I like that one, too. I will confess.
But, Kirk has some awesome hair in that one.
He does. I'm just saying.
So it would be good to reach out to you when we get to those episodes?
I would love to. Oh, my God, that would be so fun.
Awesome. And Vernon, what about you?
Oh, the Doomsday Machine.
Oh, right. Beautiful. All right. And would you come on with us and talk about it?
That would be so cool.
Awesome. Right. Awesome. Well, hey, guys, this has been an excellent interview with you guys. I'm so thankful that you guys were willing to come on and share your experience with us and our listeners. And we just want to, again, send a big thank you your way to Vernon Wilmer and April Abert.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for having us. It was fun.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, guys. This was really great.
All right. And we will see you on our next regularly scheduled episode of the Tricorder Transmissions.